Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, the Trump administration unveils Travel Ban 2.0. The Republican Congress unveils Trump Care version 1.0. We'll get reaction to both. And while much of the media obsesses on Trump's distracting tweets, we will look at a whole list today of executive branch actions getting very little attention with New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton. His article begins with how telecommunications giants like Verizon and AT&T will no longer have to take, quote, reasonable measures to protect your social security number and browsing history if you're one of their internet customers. And there is a long list from there. So we'll run down that list of underreported stories with Eric Lipton later this hour. This morning, Politico reports that at least 97 senators will align in a rare moment of bipartisanship to ask that the Trump administration offer help to Jewish community centers and other Jewish institutions facing a sharp rise in security threats. In a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, and FBI Director James Comey, the senators note, quote, at least 98 incidents of bomb threats against JCCs and Jewish schools this year, as well as reported vandalism of Jewish cemeteries in Missouri and Philadelphia. In their letter, an advance copy of which was obtained by Politico, the senators urged that the Trump administration reach out to JCCs, schools, temples, and other local centers, quote, regarding victim assistance, grant opportunities, or other federal assistance that may be available to enhance security measures and improve preparedness. By the way, in case you're wondering, since I said 97 senators, the three not signing on to the letter yet, says Politico, are Mike Lee of Utah, Mike Enzi of Wyoming, and Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Among the groups endorsing the letter are the American Jewish Committee, Anti-Defamation League, Jewish Community Center Association of North America, Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the Orthodox Union, Jewish Federations of North America, and the Union for Reform Judaism. Here in New York, Governor Cuomo has just returned from a short trip to Israel, part of the purpose of which was to stand in solidarity against anti-Semitism.
In the United States, we've had a rash of anti-Semitism, over 100 acts of anti-Semitism. And I'm sad to say also in my state, the state of New York. It is disgusting. It is reprehensible. It violates every tenet of the New York state tradition.
With Governor Cuomo on that trip and also just back in New York is my first guest today, the Israeli Consul General to New York, Ambassador Danny Dayan. Ambassador, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
Today.
Thank you for having me.
And you're just back on the red eye, like you haven't even been to sleep yet?
Exactly. I landed at JFK 4 hours ago.
Well, thanks for coming here on your way home. I hope we got you some coffee.
I did.
Governor Cuomo does not like to be away from New York, and he spent less time in Israel than on the flights to and from. What did the governor do while in Israel that helps fight anti-Semitism?
Well, first of all, he spoke obviously in English, but he said one word in Hebrew. The word is hineni. He said it in Yad Vashem, and hineni means I am here.
Yad Vashem, for people who don't know, is the Holocaust Memorial.
Museum, of course.
Yes.
A very poignant visit, and he said, hineni, I am here. And that's the reason, I think, the main reason he came, to say in these days in which the Jewish people is under attack in my jurisdiction, in New York State and elsewhere in this nation, I want to be in the center, in the capital of the Jewish people in Jerusalem to identify with you. By the way, it's the second time that the governor says hineni or acts that way. The first time a few years ago when a barrage of rockets were launched on their Israeli innocent civilians from Gaza, and again he came to say hineni, here I am.
What is going to Israel do, even if he says hineni at Yad Vashem, to fight anti-Semitism in the United States? Why wouldn't it be more relevant to go to Brooklyn and Westchester and Rockland and wherever the JCC threats or cemetery attacks or swastika scrolls have been?
I don't think there is a contradiction between doing this and doing that. I am sure he does both of them. We appreciated very much the fact that he came to identify with the Jewish people in our capital in Jerusalem. Of course, it was not only a matter of a symbolic identification. He met with our president, President Rivlin. He met with our prime minister, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He met with security officials. Maybe even more important, he met with a large group of business persons that do business with New York or intend to do business with New York.
Of course, there's anti-Semitism on the left and there's anti-Semitism on the right. The Jews seem to be subject to haters across the political spectrum, maybe uniquely. How does that look to you?
Exactly as you said. Unfortunately, we have seen in the last years anti-Semitism in this country and also in Europe coming from the left. And now we are witnessing anti-Semitism coming from the right. And I can only reflect about that very sadly, that we are used to that. Governor Cuomo said a very interesting thing that I identify with completely. He said that he believed that in this country there is a generation for which anti-Semitism will be something that belongs to the history. And here we are in a situation in which I have to educate again against anti-Semitism.
What seems to have changed is that since the Trump campaign started, the spike in expression of anti-Semitism seems to be on the right, like Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic and other Jewish journalists describing how they get Twitter sprayed with anti-Semitic hate speech from Trump supporters when they write critical things about Trump. Why do you think these anti-Semites feel an affinity for Trump?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think, as I said, that there are anti-Semites of a different kind, maybe, that use maybe a different rhetoric, also in the parties of other candidates in the last presidential election and primaries. For sure, unfortunately, some of the Sanders supporters displayed also a high level of anti-Semitism. Sometimes disguising it as anti-Zionism to be more politically correct, but it's the same awful phenomenon.
And we could have a conversation about where that line is between criticism of Israeli policy from the left that's legitimate and where it falls over into anti-Semitism. But it's presumably a different group of people than those who feel an affinity with Trump and are expressing anti-Semitism. How do you understand that group?
Till this point, we appreciate very much the action and also the rhetoric and the deeds by the Trump administration. I think that the fact that President Trump chose to start his speech, his first speech ever as President of the United States before the two houses of Congress, referring exactly to that and condemning that, I think it's very important, the fact that the incredible gesture that Vice President Pence did in St. Louis, coming by himself and helping repair the desecrated Jewish cemetery. Those are things that we appreciate tremendously, and those are that count. Now, of course, the question is deeds. And I am confident that the three levels of government in this country, the federal, the state, and the city levels, will take the necessary steps. And if they don't, we will, of course, encourage them to do that.
There was a lot of frustration on the part of American Jewish groups, as you know, that Trump didn't come out more quickly, more forcefully. He seemed to deflect it, seemed to say he didn't know about it, didn't mention Jews as the particular victims of the Holocaust on Holocaust Remembrance Day in that statement, different from past presidents. And it seemed like he really had to be boxed in order to come before Congress and try to put out the fire by starting with the clear denunciation of anti-Semitism.
No,
is that not your impression?
No, that's not my impression. We are talking about a new administration, an administration that is barely, they started barely a month in office, maybe even less than that. So we feel now that the administration takes very seriously the issue and it will confront the way it should be confronted.
My guest is Dani Dayan. He's the Israeli Consul General to New York City. Ambassador Dayan, we'll take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Staying on the anti-Semitism question for a minute before we get on to some other things, Trump is a strong supporter of Israel and Israel's conservative government in particular, which in a way makes the anti-Semitism by some of his supporters even weirder. He emboldens the Jewish right, and he emboldens the anti-Jewish right. Why do you think it turns out that way?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a commentator on American politics. I'm not even a sociologist of the American society. I can only say that the most important thing regarding the anti-Semitic acts is zero tolerance towards them, and I believe the government, federal government and other levels of government will show and are showing zero tolerance towards that, and to make, to find and bring to justice the perpetrators of the events that already happened. I understand that at least in one case, the man that was arrested has nothing to do with the Trump campaign or the Trump supporters. So I suggest, not only because I am a diplomat, but I suggest to anyone to be very, very cautious regarding allegations.
But you're not suggesting, are you, that the predominance of reports we're seeing like these are fake or
no,
that?
No, I didn't say that. Look, anti-Semitism, like terrorism, is measured not by, it's not a matter of statistics, it's a matter of impact. And unfortunately, this wave, precedented or unprecedented, it doesn't matter, has a very serious impact. I hear about parents that are taking their kids out of the JCCs, the Jewish community centers. That means this wave has an impact, and it is very dangerous, and that's the reason it has to be confronted with zero tolerance.
Let me get your and your government's reaction to the new version of the travel ban from the six Mideast countries for 90 days and all refugees for 120 days. Does Israel support this U.S. policy?
It's a domestic American matter on which we have no comment to give.
Israel is obviously a nation that radical Islamists hate. Does Israel have a travel ban nation by nation?
Israel doesn't have a travel ban nation by nation, but Israel, of course, also has its regulations. Who do we admit and who we do not admit? Who is granted a visa, who is not granted a visa? Our whole system or our whole governmental system is very different. We are a parliamentary democracy, not a republic with a president like in the United States. Our form of government is completely different, so our regulations.
I imagine Israel is very good at vetting, call it extreme vetting or whatever. Does Israel feel it's sufficient to vet people as individuals for entry into the country?
I believe that the methods that we used during the 69 years of our existence were good enough. So, by the way, I cannot say they were that we never missed. There were terrorist attacks perpetrated by foreign visitors. Not many, by the way, but there were a few. But we have a very rigorous vetting system. So, we are very proud of the fact that I came by Elal, the Israeli flag carrier, is because it's the most secure airline in the world.
Elal Airlines. So how do you vet people from countries like the six if they are, to varying degrees, failed states? The Trump administration says you can't vet people from places like Syria and Libya right now because there's no functioning government to get documents about them from.
You know, Brian, maybe my previous answer was not completely accurate. There are nations with which we do not have diplomatic relations. Most, I believe, of those, or if not all of the six countries, are countries that we do not have diplomatic relations with, and that those countries prohibit their citizens from visiting Israel. By the way, they also prohibit Israelis from visiting them. I believe there are in the world something around 17 or 18 nations that do not grant visas to Israeli citizens. So we are
you're protected by their discrimination against Israel.
You can say so.
In a certain respect. So what can the U.S. learn from the way Israel does vet?
Well, there is a very, very strong, a very, very friendly cooperation between Israel and the United States on security matters, on intelligence matters. By the way, a collaboration that was even increased during the 8 years of the Obama administration. And there are frequent mutual visits of Israeli security officials and to the U.S. and vice versa. But, you know, the nature of those talks are that they are discreet and not to be published.
I did get an email from the liberal Jewish group Americans for Peace Now objecting to Israel having what they call a travel ban on people who support boycotting Israeli businesses for political reasons. Do you have such a ban?
Well, actually, it was legislated yesterday. So the guys from Americans for Peace Now, it was legislated yesterday. I think that people that the Knesset decided that people that individuals, by the way, there's nothing about groups, an individual that works and is an activist advocating the boycott of Israel, Israel will not receive him. By the way, it's very similar, if we go back to Governor Cuomo, it's very similar to something that Governor Cuomo made in New York State by executive order. He said, whoever boycotts Israel, New York State will boycott him, will not do business with him. If Governor Cuomo can do that, of course we can do that.
Doesn't mean people aren't allowed into New York State.
No, they are not. We are talking a different issue. But people that come to Israel in order to advocate boycotting Israel, causing harm to Israel, obviously Israel has the right to defend itself. That's part of the vetting process. Yes, that's a very important part of the vetting process.
Americans for Peace Now statement says, boycotting and calling for boycotts are legitimate forms of peaceful political expression protected in any democracy. Passage of this legislation sends a message to the Israeli public and to the world that as far as the Israeli political establishment is concerned, legitimate political expression is verboten.
Political expression is permitted in Israel. You can do it whatever way you want, but we do not have any obligation to admit in our territory individuals that have stated explicitly that they come to harm our country, our economy, our fabric of life.
My guest is the Israeli Consul General to New York, Ambassador Dani Dayan, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, one of our local senators on the Foreign Relations Committee, said on Morning Joe today that our allies around the world are freaked out by how erratic President Trump is. The State Department is getting downgraded. We're for the China policy one day, against it the next. We're for Russia and against it in Ukraine at the same time. Are you also back on your heels in Israel, not knowing what to expect from one day to the next?
No. I think that following Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to Washington, which was a very successful one, we know exactly where we stand. The American administration knows exactly where we stand.
During that visit, in front of Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Trump said to the press that settlements are a problem, the opposite of what he said before.
I said, well, you know, campaign declarations are not always that's nature of politics. I don't believe there is any American president or Israeli prime minister that kept exactly the same line before election, after the elections. That's one of the deficiencies of democracy that nevertheless is, you know, Churchill said, is the worst way of government except for the others.
Right. That's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah,
he's been more erratic than most
No, I don't think so. I said that now the administration knows exactly what our positions are. We know what the positions of the administration are. They were very clear, including that one. So I don't find anything erratic in the relation with Israel. Maybe the most important thing in which President Trump was anything but erratic is the way he approaches the Iranian file, the nuclear file. He said exactly as we said, and we continue saying that it was a very bad deal for America. It was a very bad deal for Israel, the nuclear deal with Iran. And, you know, Brian, the fact that now, for the first time in 8 years, Tehran sees that there is no daylight between Israel and the United States in our approach to that issue by itself is a strategic asset that you cannot exaggerate its importance.
So what do you want in that respect? Now that it's in effect, the Iran treaty, which is not just between the U.S. and Iran, as you know, but also European other parties, now that it's in effect, do you want President Trump to abrogate U.S. participation?
You know, Brian, I think that the most important thing is The problem with that deal is that it's dangerous not only if Iran violates it, it's extremely dangerous if Iran complies with it, because it means that in 10, 12 years, Iran will be able to break out to military nuclear capabilities. I think that the United States, the current administration, understands perfectly that point, sees it eye to eye with Israel. And I assume that during the next weeks, Israeli experts and American experts will deliberate how to close that gap, how to prevent Iran in 10 to 12 years from now if it complies with the agreement. So it's not something that has to be decided in the coming days. It can be something that can be decided in the coming months, how we will deal with that. The most important thing that we deal with it jointly.
But what are you saying? Are you saying it's a matter of how it's going to be enforced rather than whether the U.S. should now leave the deal, or there's a decision-making process underway that in coming weeks might result in abrogation of the treaty?
Living or not living is a technical thing. The substantive thing is to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power after the sunset of this agreement, after it ends its 10 years.
You say after 10 or 12 years they could become a nuclear power. The Obama position was, here you have a 10, 12-year promise by Iran not to develop nuclear weapons. With no deal, they'd be doing it today.
Well, there were ways to prevent that. There were crippling sanctions that were lifted and maybe could have prevented Iran from doing that. And there were other measures that were that you not
military.
Always have to explicitly name them, that were as long as they were they're credible, they were on the table. You know, Brian,
isn't a 12 year
we have
is a 10 12 year deal not better than war?
No, the 10 12 years deal is bad, because maybe it will surprise you or your audience, but we have an intention to be around also 15 and 100 and 500 years from now. And I assume that also the United States. You know, Brian, the fact that Iran is now in the framework of the agreement, because the agreement doesn't prevent that completely, developing ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, should worry Americans, because in order to attack Israel, they do not need intercontinental ballistic missiles. They need it in order to attack the United States and Europe.
My guest is Dani Dayan, the Israeli Consul General to New York. Let me ask you about another change of a Trump position with respect to Israel, about moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Here is Trump on the embassy in his APAC speech last year.
We will move the American embassy to the eternal capital of the Jewish people, Jerusalem.
And here is Press Secretary Sean Spicer when asked about this by a reporter last month.
At the end of the president's first 4 years, will the United States embassy be in Jerusalem?
Well, I think I've answered it twice now. We are at the early stages in this decision-making process.
It's not whether, it's when and how.
There's a reason you go through a decision-making process, and that's what we're in the process of starting right now. So I just don't want to get ahead of it. If it was already a decision, then we wouldn't be going through a process.
So with reversals like that, how do you know what's coming next and that you can trust things Trump says?
Well, you know, he never said he will do it the first day of his administration. We believe it will be done. I think that every embassy, the embassy of every foreign country, should be in our capital, Jerusalem. I think it's an anomaly that the embassies of all the nations in the world are not in Jerusalem.
Spicer didn't make it clear that it's a matter of when. He was holding out the possibility.
But
it's
I
a
want
matter
to tell
if.
You, Brian, this. The commitment to move the embassy, the American embassy to Jerusalem, was not given to Israel. It was given to the American electorate. So actually we are not in a position to demand here. It's not a commitment that was given to us, but to the American people. As I said...
What does that mean? Does that mean you're not asking for it explicitly?
We would like very much, as we would like the Russian embassy and the Ukrainian embassy and the Argentinian embassy to be in Jerusalem. That's the place all embassies should be. And we look forward to the decision made by the United States at the end of the process.
Are they all in Tel Aviv now?
They are all, unfortunately, in Tel Aviv, which, as I said, is a total anomaly.
Do you really want the embassy moved to Jerusalem, or is that one of those things that's a political talking point, but in reality it would be more trouble than it's worth?
No, why wouldn't
if
we? Why
the U.S. did it?
Why wouldn't we? Of course. I think we believe that the fact that the embassies are not in our capital is... As I said, it's not just only an anomaly. I think it's more than that. It's in some way an affront, but it's an affront that keeps going 69 years, so unfortunately we got used to that.
Governor Cuomo met, I see, and for those of you just tuning in, Ambassador Dayan was accompanying Governor Cuomo on his trip to Israel to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu and stand in solidarity against the recent rise in anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic expressions in the United States, and they are both just back, and that's the occasion of the ambassador's visit. Democrats tend to be more skeptical than Republicans of Prime Minister Netanyahu's policies, as you know. Did Cuomo say anything about that to him?
Yes, actually he did. He said that the Democratic Party was traditionally the most pro-Israeli of the two American parties, and he doesn't understand why in the fringes of the Democratic Party there is a different attitude towards Israel. As a progressive, he believes Israel should be a democratic cause, and I believe he will do... He will use his influence inside the Democratic Party to make sure it happens. The Prime Minister said that we see bipartisan support of Israel to prevent Israel from becoming a wedge issue in American politics as a vital interest of the state of Israel.
Does that mean that Governor Cuomo expressed a willingness to accept not a two-state solution Israel's goal with respect to the Palestinians?
You know, I think if I can comment, I think that Governor Cuomo was very careful of coming as a governor and not as a decision maker in the American foreign policy. He didn't tackle that issue.
But if he said within the Democratic Party that he's unhappy that people are sometimes not supporting Israel, in what respect does he mean other than trying to stand firm on supporting a two-state solution?
No, I think that you cannot, unfortunately, miss the fact that in the Democratic Party, in the fringe left of the Democratic Party, there are some elements that are blatantly anti-Israeli. Some of them support BDS. I think that's what he referred to.
The boycott and divest
of Israel
movement.
I think that's what he referred to, and no more than that.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, in which Israel seized the West Bank and Gaza and more. 50 years of what's become the most controversial delegitimizing thing about Israel in the eyes of much of the world. Has it been worth it?
Well, first of all, it was imposed on us, so the question is superfluous. Second, let me remind you that we withdrew from Gaza, and Gaza is no longer under Israeli control. And third, the situation right now is that if there is one pattern in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not only in the last 50 years, even the last 100 years, that Israel, every single time a peace deal that included a very painful territorial compromise, Israel accepted it. In some occasions, it offered it, and the Palestinians rejected it. So that's a situation, actually, that the Palestinians created, and still maintain and not an Israeli decision.
What's troubling to many people with respect to Israel is the drift over time from we will hold this territory until it's safe to turn it over to the Palestinians and they finally come to yes, as Yasser Arafat refused to do, to, well, this is Judea and Samaria and the Bible and Jews have a right to live on land owned by Israel. Why shouldn't the world be troubled by that change?
I don't think there is any change. Israeli position that this is a disputed land that both that we see as our ancestral homeland was from day one. But yes, we will, and we still already, you know, that the Prime Minister Netanyahu, paying a high political price, adopted the two-state formula. But again, it was rejected by the Palestinians. So right now, we cannot be hostages to the Palestinians forever, for the Palestinian rejectionism forever. And that's, you know, I will tell you, Brian, you know who the most important person in the peace process is? He's not the Prime Minister of Israel nor the President of the United States, not even the President of the Palestinian Authority. I think the most important person is the Minister of Education of the Palestinian Authority. When the Palestinians will come to terms, as we do, that there are two groups, two nations that have a right, that are indigenous to what we call Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, and they call Palestine, there are two nations that have a just claim to that, then we'll start the peace process, which will obviously will include compromises. But right now, there is no one serious Palestinian leader that accepts our right to our being indigenous to that land.
And there is very broad denunciation of Palestinian teaching of hatred.
That's on top of the
Jews.
Basic denial of our that you saw. You know, Brian, a few weeks ago, this new Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Guterres, said the obvious, that in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount was a Jewish temple 2,000 years ago. The Palestinians immediately make a complaint by an obvious historical fact, because they want to erase our connection to that land, to portray us as colonialists.
But there is still this flirting with the idea of abandoning the context that you just articulated, that once there's a serious partner on the other side, of course there'll be two states, there'll be an Israel and a Palestine, there'll be compromises. Secretary of State Kerry, as he left office, say there's a battle for Israel's soul. You can't be both a democracy and a Jewish state in a one-state solution, because then you're permanently denying equal citizenship to millions of people. Do you accept or not accept that premise?
No, I think that's too alarmist. I think that I think that ultimately, if the Palestinians keep rejecting the two-state formula, the alternative to the rejection of the Palestinians of the two-state formula is not one-state formula, which is also impossible. We will have to be very innovative to think out of the box and to find an accommodation that will keep Israel as being both democratic and a Jewish state. How exactly that will be done, it's very difficult to speculate now.
One more thing, and back to the Trump administration. His pick for ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, who, as you know, has called liberal American Jews worse than capos, Jews who turned in their fellow Jews in the Nazi death camps. I know you don't think liberal Jews are worse than capos. Do you think it's in Israel's interest in its relationship with American Jews — Netanyahu is very controversial among American Jews — to embrace and welcome somebody who says that?
I think Mr. Friedman retracted those sayings, and I think that the prerogative of the president to nominate a person that he has confidence, I think it will be a strategic asset to the Israel-American relations if the ambassador in Israel, I hope in Jerusalem, but if not in Tel Aviv, will be a person very, very close to the president who has his complete confidence. I think it can be a strategic asset to our bilateral relations.
Are you concerned, in addition to just saying it's a strategic asset? Because you say he retracted it, but he said it in print to a newspaper. You can't undrink the cup of tea.
Well, you know, there are times in which you say something in a certain situation, and then you understand that it was a mistake, and you retract it. I think that, you know, that we have a special holiday in Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, in which you have an opportunity to do all those things. I believe that Mr. Friedman can be an excellent ambassador of the United States in Israel.
On Yom Kippur, we atone for our sins. And anything else you want to say before you go?
I want to say one more thing. We barely spoke about the economic impact of the visit of the governor. I want just to say one word, one sentence about that. You know, Israel is a country in which every 8 hours a new startup company with some kind of innovation or hopeful innovation is created. Actually, it's not every 8 hours because we have holidays and things, and people in Israel even sleep. You don't believe that. So actually, it's every 2 business hours. I am happy to say that more than 300 of those companies have already opened shop in New York. And the rate of growth is in the magnitude of 10 or 12 every month. I think it's an amazing contribution, a mutual contribution to Israel and to New York. And we decided to encourage the increase of that. For me, that's a very important part, both of the visit and my tenure as Consul General of Israel in New York.
Ambassador Dani Dayan, thank you very much for coming
in. Thank you, Brian.
Now go get some sleep after coming in on the red eye. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how the corporate swamp is influencing the Trump administration, including in the new House health care reform bill. Stay with us.